turn on your mic. I will turn it on. Are we on the air? It's 12:15. Good afternoon to you, Michael Knight, and my very special guest, Nikolai Kouli. Nicholas Kouli. I'll tell you about that joke later. God, what a brain I have. I just wish it was hooked up to something. This is the last hurrah for the season of the Wenatchee Valley Symphony Orchestra, and it's going to be an adventurous mashup between the creations and the characters of William Shakespeare and the classical works based on his theatrics and his sonnets and his characters, his plays, and his images. We begin with Otto Ravel, Overture to the Merry Wives of Windsor, which our local pianist Jody Graves is going to play on the piano, and then featured in Ravel's Piano Concerto in G. That's what she plays, okay? And it'll be followed by Vaughan Williams, who I used to know for his piece called The Lark Ascending. But for this concert, we're going to be playing and listening to The Serenade to Music, which will ascend like a lark to your lobes. As in hipsters, flipsters, and finger-poppin' daddies, lend me your lobes. I come to dig Caesar, not to cool him. And then finally, Dmitri Shostakovich, who apparently had huge hands, whose Hamlet film suite will no doubt feature his trademarks of sharp contrast and ambivalent tonality, and we're listening to it right now. He's got a thing called To Be or Not to Be, which comes up later. Shostakovich was heavily influenced by Igor Stravinsky, and I didn't know that until I listened to this piece. And there's a piece in there that sounds like it's right out of the ballet. What's the ballet?
Rite of Spring.
What is it?
Rite of Spring.
The Rites of Spring. There you go. Sounds just like it to me. I'm glad Nikolai's here. And now we leave, as we must, the last words to Willie the Shake. And although I don't know the stuff I just said, I do know something about this. Shakespeare seemed to say, with foreknowledge, and that I write about music a lot. I just do, he said. He was tweeting. He said, and for the music, I love you, Willie. And he also wrote this. If music be the food of love, play on, Twelfth Night. And that gets misquoted a lot. I've always heard it said, if music be the food of love, then play on. But if you ask Willie the Shake, he'll tell you that I'm sorry, we can't say then. It doesn't scan with that. And then there's this one. Orpheus with his lute made trees and the mountaintops that freeze bow themselves. When he did sing, to his music plants and flowers ever sprung as sun and showers here had made a lasting spring. Everything that heard him play, even the billows of the sea hung their heads when he lay by. In sweet music as such art, killing care and grief of heart fall asleep, or hearing die. That's Henry VIII. And lastly, and I only mention this as a cautionary tale, the man that hath no music in himself, nor is not moved with concord of sweet sounds, is fit for treasons, stratagems, and spoils. The motions of his spirit are dull as night, and his affections dark as a rebus. Let no such man be trusted. Mark the music. From The Merchant of Venice. And I don't want to be a know-it-all, Nicholas, but I had to look up what a rebus was. Do you know that one?
No.
I didn't either. A rebus was one of the primordial deities in Greek mythology, born out of the primeval void called chaos. He was the personification of deep darkness and shadows. Whew! Swelled up the music just in time for that. How about that? Shostakovich, always the dramatic guy. So we welcome our very special guest today. He's Nicholas Kouli. He's not only the conductor, but the music director for the Wenatchee Valley Symphony. And I suppose you put together this program, searched through, you Googled Shakespeare and music and saw what came up?
Well, it's not hard to do that because there's so many pieces out there by classical composers inspired by Shakespeare. Many operas like Otello, A Midsummer Night's Dream by Benjamin Britten. Then we have some other pieces like Tchaikovsky's Romeo and Juliet that were inspired by Shakespeare, Macbeth by Verdi. Mendelssohn also did his own Midsummer Night's Dream, Benjamin Britten as well. So lots of stuff out there. So it was really a matter of picking and choosing which pieces to add to this particular program.
And you knew you had a soloist coming, so you had to get something for the piano, I guess?
Yeah, we've been wanting to invite Jody Graves to our orchestra for quite some time. She's a local pianist, or a native Wenatchee. She now teaches at Eastern Washington University. And I spoke to her about playing with us, and I gave her two or three options for a piano concerto, and she picked this Ravel.
Had she played it before?
She has played it before. She's played with a symphony before, too. She told me she played Beethoven's fourth piano concerto many years ago. And I believe she played this Ravel piano concerto with her own Eastern Washington University Symphony Orchestra just recently.
So when you chose these, you had to pick the order that they were going to go in too. So that if you go to the website, you get a different order. But the truth is, you're going to be going in this order.
The order begins with the overture, of course, Otto Nicolai's overture to the opera, The Merry Wives of Windsor. Then the Ravel Piano Concerto in its more traditional spot right before intermission with Jody, which has nothing to do with Shakespeare. And we have an intermission, then we'll play this lush D major serenade to music by Vaughan Williams without voices in its orchestra version. And then we'll finish with the essentially a soundtrack to the film Hamlet.
I find Vaughan Williams interesting because I found him by accident one day. I didn't, as you probably can guess, I don't know a great deal about classical music, but I found his record on Angel Music, which I always loved Angel Records because they had such great labels.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd heard about the Lark Ascending, but I didn't know what it was. But it really is a musical version of a lark taking to the sky. And it's fascinating, really. You can see it. You can hear it. It's all beautiful. So is all his work similar to that in that it evokes an image to the listener?
Yes. In fact, I could probably do a concert just about birds with the Lark Ascending and the Pines of Rome. There are birds in this. And then there is Birds by Respighi. But in general, Vaughan Williams' music is lush sounding. It seems like there's always some sort of motion happening from the middle voices, always kind of undulating up and down with these running triads of eighth notes. And you see this in the Lark Ascending, you see this in the Serenade to Music, but you also see it in his symphonies. He tends to think in a choral fashion, thinking about lyricism and thinking about voices, but he's also influenced by the sea, his country being completely surrounded by water. These English composers tend to think about, okay, what does the sea mean to our existence? What does the sea mean for our life? And actually, how can the sea be a physical manifestation or maybe a metaphor for our sanity or insanity in our head?
And, of course, it's a good thing the sea was there, or France would have been part of England a long time ago. Or that's the other way around. I don't know which it would
exactly
have been. I don't know who would have won out on that. They'd probably still be disagreeing about it. Is Vaughan Williams a relatively modern composer?
Not really. I would probably put him in the category of a traditionalist. He sought to do things that were from the past, maybe an extension of Brahms. Yes, he did these things that involve words, like the Serenade to Music, the Sea Symphony. But he was really more a traditionalist. And if you put him up against other English composers like Elgar, like Benjamin Britten, and of course today's living composers like Thomas Addis, Vaughan Williams looks like the most traditional, most conservative of that bunch.
Dmitri Shostakovich was neither conservative in any way that I can think of. His music is so emotional, and especially, well, what's your favorite piece by him?
Shostakovich is probably most known for his Fifth Symphony, but he is also well known to have been a victim or at the center of a conflict between expression of his own personal art and then the expression of the art as required of him by the Soviet regime. So his music tends to have a strife and angst to it. There are moments of great sunshine in his music, and it's clear that that's his personal voice. There are moments of great military kinds of sounds, Soviet kinds of sounds. So you hear lots of snare drums that sound like AK-47s.
Wow.
Or the entire orchestra in unison at a low register that's meant to sound like the military. But then you also get these moments of sarcasm from Shostakovich, at places where you can tell that he's just thrown his hands up in the air. I can't either do this or that. I can't be me. I can't be them at the same time. So he decides just to be sarcastic with his music, and it has this crass, kind of humorous but macabre feel to it.
Humorous but macabre. Oh God, that sounds like Night Before Halloween or whatever it's called.
Exactly. And so when you hear this music in the film suite, yes, it's supposed to accompany this English play, but there's a Soviet sound to it. Very, very imposing. There are moments of Mozart, there are moments of Ravel, but in general, it sounds very Russian.
I didn't know this until today. I was reading about his life. He had a patron, which is what everyone wants, except his patron happened to be a high-ranking official in the Soviet military.
Yes.
So he got to create, he got to be famous, he got to record, but he was also prevailed upon to be a good Soviet. And that meant, you know, doing what you just mentioned, which made him throw up his hands, and which caused a lot of controversy between the two men, the patron and the creator.
And this actually was a problem for anyone that wanted to perform his music outside of Russia, because the state actually owned his music. They owned the rights to his estate. And you had to ask for permission to get these parts, and they're very hard to get. They're expensive. And the typesetting that we're so accustomed to from other works that's so clear and ready presentable, they weren't very, very clear from the Russian state, and so these things were very, very difficult to perform. Now, I think the Statute of Limitations ran out on most of his music, I'm going to say maybe 10, 15 years ago. Now, publishers are actually taking his music and engraving them, and it's very, very clear. I think it's called the Shostakovich, or the New Collected Works of Shostakovich, and so his parts are more easily readable. And you can see this stuff in the works of Prokofiev. You can also see this stuff in the works of Stravinsky. These works that were owned by the state for such a long time.
And did they make use of those copyrights? Did they make sure they got recorded so there was income from them? Or were they too foolish to exploit them?
I think they were performed publicly within their country. I don't think they did anything about, you know, for any financial gain.
It was just control.
It was control.
Wow.
Yeah, exactly. It was control not only of the material for distribution, but it was control of the content itself. They wanted to make sure that the content reflected Russian values and Russian mores. So, yeah, it's a different kind of country.
I wonder if people know enough about Shakespeare to remember that he liked to do songs in his plays. It was fun to have perhaps one of his lighter characters like Falstaff sing a song in a pub or in a roadhouse, and that was like musical relief, comic relief. It's something that he used regularly, and it's also songs that Ophelia would sing her song when she lost her mind, about as a child would sing. So he knew the value. He knew his audience so well. He knew how to entertain and break up the action with a song or a comic relief scene.
That's actually very natural. I mean, if someone that thinks about the prosody of words and the rhyming schemes of words, so often, of course, it would lend well to apply the rhythm of words and the sounds of words into these songs. But like as you cited with all those examples, usually these songs come as in stark contrast to the drama at the time. While they're singing a pleasant and lyrical and serene song, there's quite a bit of underlying strife and drama as they're singing those serenades.
He was a good one for referring to beauty, and then in the next scene, there's a killing.
Exactly, exactly. And I'm sure that's why, you know, the Benjamin Brittens, the Verdis, why they took these operas these plays and applied them to opera.
There was a guy that wrote, I wish I could remember his last name right now. I think his name was Kahn. He was the chair of the English department at Yale. You know this guy? He came up with the idea that there was only a few artists in what he called the Western canon. Who are the men who write in English who have outlined how to write stories throughout time? And there's only two guys that he came out with that were original. One was William Shakespeare, who was the archetype of every writer to follow him until 1930s, when Franz Kafka was born, and he was the second. So the two men at the top of the English canon were the crazy man, William Shakespeare, who wrote to stay alive. He wrote to be employed.
Right.
And Franz Kafka, who wrote everything to destroy it so no one would ever read it. That was his last wish. Everything must be destroyed. One of his greatest fears was someone would stumble upon his works and read them. That was so frightening to him. The concept was more than he could bear.
That's right. I think you could say that probably about music. You know, everything in the musical tree probably comes together with either Bach for his counterpoint and for his cantatas.
And the blues.
Yes, and I was going to say, actually, Beethoven. And after that, somehow, all music, and I'm going to include rap, I'm going to include rock music, I'm going to include jazz, somehow are branches from these two composers.
Well, Shakespeare would immediately notice all the couplets in rap, but he might say, I believe that technique is overused.
Exactly.
That's not rhyming, that's writing. Truman Capote said of Jack Kerouac, that's not writing, that's typing.
But funny.
That was just to be nasty. He knew that he was a stylist that Capote couldn't match. So that was his vicious response.
There are actually criticisms of current composers, living composers, and I won't name who those composers are, that they would say that this is not writing, you're just copying and pasting.
Yeah, right, exactly. And there's a lot of that in creation. They just take, well, we have that verse done, so we'll just copy and paste the basic tracks, and bingo, you got another verse. I haven't written it yet. Doesn't matter. We'll pick it up here tomorrow.
That's right.
Just plug you into the machine. Our very special guest is Nicholas Kowili. I've been calling him Nikolai because of all the mistakes I made about Ravel. At any rate, he's here, whatever his name is. It's 12:31. We'll be back to talk about the symphony performance tomorrow night, right after these words.
Dealership. Call 888-9595. That's The Agenda with Michael Knight on News Radio 560 KPQ and KPQ.com.
It's 12:35 at News Radio 560 KPQ. You're listening to The Agenda. We have 57 degrees outside. It's a sunny, cloudy, sort of breezy day, everything at once, as we're trying to get spring organized here in Wenatchee Valley. My very special guest is Nicholas Kowili. He's the conductor and the music director for the Wenatchee Valley Symphony Orchestra. And as music director, it's your job to pick the tunes. You're the music box man. You put the quarter in and tell them what to play. And have you made up your mind, maestro?
I do. I have a plan for our 2019-2020 season. This is about when I submit this to our board, and they get to take a look at it and make sure it meets their particular needs and their desires, and they can go ahead and approve it. But I can maybe hint at what's going on next year.
I know you haven't announced it officially, so you can be as cryptic as you want.
Of course.
By the way, is there anybody on the board who plays bassoon? Because they're constantly going to say, I think we need more bassoon.
Sometimes you get boards like that where there are definitely particular tastes. But, this summer we will for sure do our Independence Day concert as usual. We love playing down there by the river and doing that big program there with the fireworks behind us. That's been a fan favorite for such a long time. And we will also have this amazing performance at a town Toyota Center with Weird Al Yankovic on his strings required concert tour that happens on August 13th. And then when you come back to see us in the 2019-2020 season, we'll do our usual four concert series, a couple in the fall, one in the winter, one in the spring, and we'll do our Nutcracker as usual in December. But I have a couple tricks up my sleeve for our season next year. I'll just hint that concert number two will occur on November 2nd. I will say it's only 2 days away from Halloween. So perhaps Halloween might have inspired me for this particular program. And then in concert three, I'll be exploring a lot of Spanish repertoire. So how's that for just a little bit of a
Do you remember the theme
taste
that they used in the Bela Lugosi version of Dracula? It was and it played all the time as he's walking down the stairway, and I go, what is that thing? But it turns out to be a kind of an innocent musical piece, but with him walking, it becomes so sinister.
That's right. That's right. I mean, if you can affix some imagery with some of this music, it can be quite memorable.
Now, Weird Al, what's the date for Weird Al, if we can still get tickets?
Yes, those tickets are available. That's on August 13th. It's a Tuesday. Weird Al is just touring all over the country. He's going to be in Northwest during that time. I think he's doing a show in Seattle. He's going to do a show in Oregon, Northern Oregon. And so he's added a show here with Wenatchee. That's with our orchestral musicians. But I found out recently that he's bringing his own conductor.
What?
So the dream that I had to conduct, this is the dream I've held close to my heart for years and years and years.
This is an outrage, sir.
Which I thought was going to be fulfilled, now will not be fulfilled. So I've spoken with some of the staff, and they said, well, maybe you can play some instruments in the orchestra.
They're going to put you on tambourine?
Why? I was a percussionist in a former lifetime, so I either play piano in the orchestra, or maybe I'll play some sort of percussion instrument.
Maybe the Vox organ would be in keeping with his music.
Yeah, there you go.
Well, you know, Weird Al plays I normally don't say this word on the radio, accordion.
Yes.
And that is a much reviled instrument among certain intelligentsia. Or do I have that wrong? Is it just a joke?
Well, you wouldn't see it very often with a classical symphony orchestra, but you'll see this often with klezmer music, folk music.
Wisconsin polka bands.
Polka music. There's a certain kind of sounds there. I think the closest relative that you might see in a symphony orchestra would be what I call a harmonium.
Mm-hmm, yeah, with a pump.
With the foot pump. And it still has that kind of airy, wheezy, not very powerful sound. But we've seen that used with an orchestra by Arnold Schoenberg in his way to kind of mimic the sound of horns.
But the accordion itself is usually left for the for the Midwest polka dancers.
For the life of me, I can't think of one piece by a major classical composer that uses accordion.
Okay, we'll let the topic rest there. If you have an accordion under your bed hiding in your bedroom, you can dispose of it. There's no one looking now, I can tell you. Of course, it's going to make all that noise when you put it in the garbage. While we revile instruments, I had a friend who is a professional violin player, and his favorite joke was, do you know why the viola is larger than the violin? And I said, I have no idea. And he says, they burn longer.
Yeah.
And he would laugh till he had tears in his eyes. And he told that joke once a week. So I don't know what it was that would compel him to do it. I suppose it's something that violin players have over the sad viola player. But then you get to the cello and the majesty returns, so there's nobody else to pick on except the poor grandma playing the viola right there in the orchestra. But it's a beautiful instrument. It really is. It's got its own mellow sound, unlike the accordion.
Yes. Yeah, the viola has its a beautiful, a sonorous, not powerful, but wide sound.
You need it for the harmony. Last time we did the Planets by Holst, you guys had extra people. You had extra percussion, and you had to bring in some people for the explosions and the majesty of giant planets in orbit.
That's right. I mean, viola does fill in the middle, and the percussion helps out, but there are composers who use the viola really well. For example, Brahms. I don't know if we've talked about this before, but in Brahms especially, he'll put the cellos above the violas. And that kind of combination of registers where the cello's in its powerful range and the viola's in its kind of throaty, sonorous range makes for a really amazing combination.
As you get a whole new picture when the altos sing the top and the tenor takes the melody and then the baritones actually sing a harmony.
Exactly. That kind of inversion of voice types where you're not supposed to stay in your lane.
No.
Creates a really amazing sound.
Well, you said you could play an instrument with Weird Al. I hope you do. But would you rather be on the percussion or on the piano?
You know, since being the music director of the Wenatchee Valley Symphony, I have yet to have played in a concert while not conducting.
Wow.
So it would be really interesting for me to actually play with another conductor.
Are you going to watch the other conductor or just disregard him, wear shades and avert your gaze?
No comment, Michael.
They don't call him maestro because it's just a word, okay? There's more to it than that. You have to be in charge. Our super guest is Nicholas Coeli. We'll be back in a moment to talk about music and what you're doing. By the way, do you have tickets for tomorrow night's show?
We do have tickets. You can find them at the New America Performing Arts Center website. You can also go to WenatcheeSymphony.org, and you can find tickets and links there to purchase.
Beautiful. It's the last show of the season, so don't sit home on the couch, okay?
You're listening to The Agenda on News Radio 560. The Agenda with Michael Knight on News Radio 560 KPQ and KPQ.com.
12:48 on a Friday afternoon. The weekend has begun. I've kicked open the gate to the weekend. It has begun. Don't let it get started without you. So officially, just let somebody know at work the weekend is upon us. Tick, tick. Let's have a good time. Saturday night, you can go see the symphony. Why not? It's Shakespeare in Love. And keep in mind this, and I think the Meister would agree with me, when Shakespeare wrote about love, it was a comedy. But when he wrote about lovers, it was a tragedy.
That's right. Romeo and Juliet.
God. And the Taming of the Shrew was supposed to be about two people who would never get together, and that turned out to be a fabulous comedy.
That's right.
Hamlet, not too many laughs there. The Merry Wives of Windsor, I guess that can be a good comedy. Anything with Falstaff in it was a good comedy.
That's right.
Of course, they were mostly about mad kings going their own way, but Falstaff would break up the action and be a good companion, a good drinking companion, apparently. There is, I think in those characters that we just mentioned, that's the archetype that they were talking about in the canon of Western literature. Everything that we think about in terms of plot, characterization, surprise endings,
mm-hmm.
unexpected death, treachery, all that was invented by him. He took all the plots in the world and used every one of them in every one of his stories.
That's right. I think, there are about 7 stock plots. I think they're also, at least in Italian drama, there are about 7 stock characters. There are the lovers, there's the comedian, there's the villain, and it goes on and on and on. I think you see that in Shakespeare's plays as well.
And the clowns, the one that gets hit and the one that gets does all the hitting, Jocko and what the other one is, I can't remember.
That's right, Pagliacci and Petrushka. Yeah. The clown that's there to entertain, but at the same time is feeling sadness from within.
And we use this every day in music and in television. You can tell by the music on the entrance what we're dealing with. There's tension in the air. This is the villain. Now you know. You don't have to introduce him twice. Let him walk in the room to the certain kind of music, and you have a villain. Let somebody walk into the certain kind of music. There's your beautiful lead. Here's the handsome but tragic lover who's going to probably not make it through the third act. It's wonderful that we can play along with them in our minds, but also still be surprised by the twists and turns in the plot. And does anybody write music like that where you hear it coming, you hear, this sounds like the Beach Boys, and then it turns into a mess at the beach?
Yeah, we have a musical version of that, and it's actually, there's a name for it, it's called Deceptive Resolution.
Name of my new book.
Exactly. So where the music would probably go in one direction and you expect it to go that direction and it changes suddenly, we call that some sort of deceptive resolution.
And that's a way to describe some of Shostakovich's work. They say it was described mostly as a work that you would know it was him because of the sharp contrast. It's doing one thing and he's not afraid to change it dramatically.
That's right. This piece that we're going to do in 8 movements from the film Suite, and basically chopping up the entire soundtrack for the film into 8 parts, is as big as everyone playing at once in fortissimo, but as small as just the strings playing in a very, very light character. So the stark contrast in size and scope of this piece is very, very large.
And very Russian, yes?
Very Russian. Low register, minor key, the snare drum that sounds like a machine gun, the strings that are using eighth note ostinatos, all that instantly tell that this is Shostakovich.
Is that when the bow hits the strings?
Well, an ostinato meaning that it repeats a certain rhythm.
Ah, yes.
Or something, some sort of cell that repeated over and over and over again. You'll hear that in this particular piece.
Is it true that he had large hands and he could play chords with a certain kind of reach that other people couldn't recreate?
You know, I didn't know about Shostakovich, but Rachmaninoff.
That's it. Sergei Rachmaninoff.
Very large hands, and you know that by his writing, and you should probably look up Dudley Moore and his comedic sketch on how to properly play Rachmaninoff preludes. He actually created these 2x4 stencils where he could just take one and it's put it down on the piano and actually accomplish and execute those chords that mere mortals could not.
Speaking of guys who do weird piano things, did you know that Irving Berlin could only play in one key, so he had the keyboard that had a gear shift on it?
I did not
know
that.
And he would just move the keyboard so he could play in G, even though he switched it so he was in E or F sharp or whatever it was.
I need one of those. I need one of those transposing pianos.
I think we all need one of those. It worked for him. He had a couple hits. It's fascinating how someone with very little musical official breeding or education finds themselves as a Tin Pan Alley hit, and all they can do is play, you know, what was the name of the band? The band was Three Great Guys, and they played Three Great Chords, and that was it.
Oh, all these garage bands, the Beatles, you know, they just come up with a sound without writing anything, any of these notes down. They just had a great sound.
And what was your first instrument?
My first instrument was piano.
And then you went on to play how many now?
Well, I learned a little bit of cello, I learned a little bit of clarinet, I learned a little bit of violin, and then I finally settled on percussion as my principal non-piano instrument so I can be a part of the orchestra and bands. But piano is kind of the number one instrument there.
How come the timpani players, or kettle drum if you don't know what I'm talking about, hit their drums and then kill the resonation so that the note is finished?
You explained it just right there, that they are trying to control duration of the notes. You know, whereas on a violin, you run out of bow, you stop the bow, then the note ends. Or if you're a clarinet player, you stop your air, then the note ends. Well, once you hit a percussion instrument, timpani, cymbals, chimes, you have to bring it to an end somehow, and that usually, for a timpanist, it means putting your hand on the top of the drum or the head to stop the sound.
Otherwise, it goes into a part of the presentation that where it doesn't belong.
That's right.
It goes forever.
It could vibrate forever.
Well, I'm sorry this is the end of the symphony orchestra season, but when will we see you again?
Well, this is our last official of the season, but I'll probably see you July 4th for the Independence Day concert.
I look forward to
I'll be in town, of course, for the Weird Al Yankovic concert. And, Michael, I'll probably be joining you for our September concert when we begin our next season. Oh, sorry, the beginning of October, the first week of October.
We'll see you then. Well, next time, 4th of July, we'll book it right now. And I bid you adieu. That's Nicholas Cowilly. He's the conductor and the music director for the Wenatchee Valley Symphony. Get your tickets. See his show about Shakespeare in Love tomorrow.
You're listening to The Agenda on News Radio 560 KPQ and KPQ.com.